This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
The art of being able to tell a really interesting story is still really, really important. I'm a high achiever and a perfectionist, but I put a lot of pressure on myself. And journos favour PRs that can provide them with the full kit and caboodle that they can run across socials, online and in print.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 3232. Thank you very much for coming back. We really appreciate you tuning in. Once again, we are back to a new format in the Simon Dell Show. We're no longer going to have the spin cycle and the long form interview in the same show. We are going to have the interviews in their own show, and we are going to have our own show for the spin cycle, which means we can all fart on in the spin cycle for as long as we like without it dragging on, and everybody can skip that episode if they like, because we think most people were just fast forwarding 20 minutes in the old episodes. But anyway, you know, it just allows me, Patrick and Eddie, and sometimes poor old Kim to get dragged into long-winded arguments where we take the piss out of each other. But that will all be confined to its own episode now. Anyway, the long-form interview this week is a lady in Melbourne called Lucy Allen, who is the business director of an organisation called Thrive PR. And she's also started her own little side hustle called the Graceful Collective. All those links will be in the show notes, so you can go and check that out before you start listening to her or after you start listening to her. Fantastic story. We talk about her time when she was on Deal or No Deal. We talk about her throwing up over five English journalists, and we talk about her obsession with nipples. You're going to need to listen to this episode to understand all of those things. Lucy is very, 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 very interesting, very smart, hugely entertaining. So listen in, and I think you'll get a lot out of what she does. She's a PR by nature, so she has some great advice and suggestions for people who are running their businesses, irrespective of the size of them. So listening to Lucy, the last few bits and notices, please give them, rate and review us on iTunes. That'd be fantastic. Please go and check out Gilberto's podcast. Not his podcast, he's the Podcast Boss website, if you're looking to do your own podcast. And finally, if you want to come and talk to me, simon@simondell.com. I'm on LinkedIn as I Am Simon Dell. I'm on Twitter as I Am Simon Dell. And if you're looking for any kind of digital marketing support, consultants, execution support, come and chat to me and Matt. Find out all about us at www.simondell.com. Matt is still dealing with having to call himself simondell.com, but he'll get over it eventually. Anyway, that is all for the introduction. Please enjoy my interview with Lucy Allen. It's extremely entertaining, and we'll talk to you at the end. I'm joined by Lucy Allen, who is down in Melbourne today, and it's probably a lot colder down there than it is in Brisbane. She is the business director of an organisation called Thrive PR and Communications, and she also has her own little side hustle called the Graceful Collective, which we'll hear about later on. So, Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Simon.
First question I ask everybody is, when was your first job, your first paid job? And what did you do?
Okay, my first paid job would have been, gosh, I was probably about 13.
Yep.
And it was a paper run. So I think, quite ironic that my first job was working for a paper. And, you know, I now work for a PR agency. Actually, let me correct that. My first job was managing my dad to do my paper run.
Do you know what? There's been a few people whose first jobs were paper runs here. And I had the same thing where, actually, no, I didn't. My dad did my brother took over my paper round, and then my dad ended up taking it over from my brother. So why did you make your dad do it?
Oh, it was just such effort, wasn't it? I'd read the newspaper from cover to cover, and that was, what the enjoyment that I got out of it. So I'd send him on his way like a camel with two bags strapped across his chest, and he'd smash it out for me.
And how long did this last until he pointed out that you were getting paid and he probably wasn't getting paid for this?
Look, it probably went for about 12 months.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a great dad, and it turns out I'm quite good at people management, so worked well.
If anybody knows Lucy's dad out there, please just give him a punch in the arm. Clearly, I think you've missed the entire point of a paper round there, but
I got to know the paper, so that was
I was going to say that is the bonus out of that. I was looking at, I've been looking at your sort of your career. Obviously, huge. Lots of experience in PR. What sort of graduated you to that in the first place?
Oh, look, when I was back at school, to be honest, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I absolutely loved to write. And so in my first year of uni, I did some work experience at ACP, so at Clio magazine, and really got to see the ins and outs of a mag and, you know, what made news and how to construct a great story. And I really took that opportunity to get in front of some influential writers and editors at the time, which ultimately actually led me on to being able to freelance for the mag. So to be honest, initially I thought I would work in journalism. I'd work for one of the magazines, but straight out of uni, you know, working and living in Melbourne, found myself, I got an opportunity at Style Council, so a local PR agency here. And I grew my knowledge and my love of PR from working agency side.
What was it about writing that sort of got you excited back in those days when you were still a teenager?
Yeah, I just love writing in terms of being able to really express yourself and say what you really think, and being able to add commentary to a range of different issues and topics. I've loved it, you know, right since I was a kid. I used to write stories and present news bulletins that my family would have to watch. And yeah, I'm a storyteller, so I love telling those stories. I think it's really exciting.
Tell me how one of those news bulletins went as a child. Did you make them all sit on the sofa and listen to you?
Simon, I actually recorded them. So wow. What I would do, I would sit at my dad's desk when he was off doing the paper run. And I'm from New Zealand, so you probably can't hear it now, but I would sort of start and say, you know, good evening, this is Lucy and you're listening to One Network News. And then I would launch straight into the top headlines of the day. I'd record that and then have everyone sit down and play it through the TV.
Wow.
Loser.
No, I'm not judging you at all. Everyone did strange things as a kid, but there we, yes. You know, what sort of stories were you writing back then? Were you kind of very sort of driven towards writing fiction?
I was. Look, in my news bulletins, they were based on fact. Right, so I used to do, you know, kiwi fruit competitions and all sorts. But no, when I was a child, I loved writing fictional stories, almost sort of Harry Potter-esque of, you know, different adventures that kids would have at school and off on camps and the likes.
Do you ever think about going back and still writing those kind of things now?
Well, you know what the wonderful thing is? I can actually bring my writing into my PR work.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, I'm now a professional storyteller and I still get to work closely with media, and my job really is to come up with those unique narratives for my clients. So I still
you've
get
never,
to
You've never thought that, but sitting down and writing a novel yourself?
To be honest, no. No, I've kind of moved away from it. I love doing blog posts and, short format content.
The reason I ask that is I've read two books in the last 3 or 4 months by Australian journalists who clearly there seems to be this renaissance of sort of journalist and writing professionals going back and writing novels. I'm going to forget the name of the first author, but the second one was a guy called Trent Dalton, who's quite a significant journalist, and he's just released a book called Boy Swallows Universe, which was absolutely fantastic book. But it seems that there's a lot of writers and journalists now sort of realizing as the marketplace changes that there's an opportunity for them to write something more fiction wise. So there you go. Anyway, so maybe there's a generation that have missed out on your version of Harry Potter and things like that.
Perhaps I'll put some thought to it.
So when you sort of went to that first role at the Style Council, what sort of clients were you working with then?
Gosh, back then my biggest client was Target. Right. So it was an awesome, awesome account to cut my teeth on. For anyone listening, it's a major retailer here in Australia. And really our role was to try and amplify the profile of the brand from a fashion perspective. So this was back in the day when Target were a major partner of the Melbourne Fashion Festival. Right. We initiated the Designers for Target collaborations, you know, working with the likes of Stella McCartney and a suite of designers who did these special capsule ranges for the retailer. My role was, I was furiously down in the wardrobe sort of area, sending out products and liaising with editorial teams to try and get Target featured on their pages.
I was going to say, back in those days, and that's 2008 and 2010, which obviously then explains to everybody how old you are.
Thank you.
but there was no, I mean, there was very little social media back then, wasn't there?
Oh, I don't think there was any.
No, I think there was early days of things like Facebook and stuff like that. So, so there's obviously no, you know, there was no live tweeting from the backstage of those kind of things. It was still very traditional PR.
Correct. Yeah, I think at that stage we were just starting to think about working with bloggers. So it was very, very early days, but it was traditional PR and trying to get earned media, typically for a client like Target, within the print pages of the mags and the newspapers.
What stayed the same between 2008 and 2018 in the PR world? Is there still that, you know, would you still try and go and get, that earned media in print today? Mm. Is that the sort of thing that clients are looking for?
Oh, 100%. Certainly at my role at Thrive PR, earned media is the bread and butter of what we do. And it's what a lot of our major clients actually come to us for. So the art of being able to tell a really interesting story around a commercial brand and earn space for that story within print, TV, online radio, is still really, really important. I think what's changed is that there's now a whole range of other communications channels and options for getting that story heard.
Do you think it's easier now than it was back then, or it's harder?
Oh, to be honest, I think it's getting harder. I think it's wonderful in the fact that, you know, we've got this diverse array of channels. So the opportunity is so much broader, but you've got to be so much savvier with how you get your message in and really warrant the space within, you know, that blog or that social site or whatever it might be. It's so competitive. And you also need to be providing a really compelling story that's brought to life with really unique assets. So cracking video, animation, infographics, you've got to have data and insights. Newsrooms, as we know, are shrinking these days. So journos favour PRs that can provide them with the full kit and caboodle that they can run across, you know, socials, online and in print.
Is that, bear in mind that that's Target, and obviously they have the budget to be able to utilise an agency, you know, like the Style Council, or now with some of your existing clients, they have those kind of budgets. If you're a sort of a small to medium sized business, you know, putting all that together is a bit of a challenge. What would you say probably the top two or three things that people, if a business is going after earned media, what should they be making sure they're getting right?
Well, you know what? It's interesting, Simon, because I think you're right. Those big brands do have the budgets. But to be honest, PR has often been the sort of poor cousin of the marketing and advertising space. And we've certainly not had the big budgets, you know, like some of the creative agencies have. So we have had to be quite nimble and innovative in the way that we work and in the approaches that we make. Really, at the crux of it, the key to great PR is just a unique story or a unique take on something. I actually was, I don't know if you saw Q&A last week with Dylan Alcott.
Yes.
So Dylan Alcott is an Australian Paralympian, and they did a special around disability and inclusion. And it was just brilliant. This is an alternate example of PR that didn't cost a thing. Dylan is the host of Triple J, and one of his listeners rang up and challenged him to include references to the iconic Wu-Tang Clan within Q&A, which is, you know, quite a conservative program. Yeah. And so I just thought it was brilliant. He was able to bring
bring that in. And he then, off the back of so cleverly integrating these cultural references to Wu-Tang, he got so much additional coverage around the segment and who he is as an identity and his work in championing disability. You know, you had Pedestrian TV and news.com and all of these youth targets talking about Q&A and about Dylan. So I think that's a great example of, you know, just thinking innovatively, being quite reactive. News hijacking is something we recommend a lot with our clients. So every day here at Thrive, we actually sit down, we go through every newspaper across the country. We've got breakfast TV on, we've got all the radio networks on and people listening to different things. Yeah. And we look at what are the headlines of the day and how might we be able to weave one of our clients into these for maybe comment on that story or some type of new take on what's being discussed.
So really a smaller business needs to do those kind of things, but just like on a more, you know, smaller or a local scale.
Correct. Yep.
You know, just looking at local, you know, maybe more localized media or, you know, maybe more localized, you know, celebrities or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, sometimes what smaller organizations fail to do is look inward and actually, you know, assess what great stories they already have within their organization. And that might be around amazing talent that they've got on board. It could be around the new product, could be the innovation pipeline. There's often so many rich storytelling opportunities that really they require a great spokesperson, maybe a couple of images and a solid pitch into the right media target.
You ended up doing a bit of time in London. Most Australians and New Zealanders do, but what sort of made you go over there?
Oh, so I went to London, I would have been, about 20, 23. To be honest, it had been ingrained in me since I was a kid that I would one day move to London. It was what my parents did. It's where they actually met. So I knew I wanted to get into uni and I knew I wanted to get some local experience under my belt so that I could actually get over to London and work in the field. So I did sort of 18 months, I think it was, at Style Council, and then packed my bags up actually after being a successful contestant on the Aussie game show Deal or No Deal. And I won.
Okay.
Yeah. So I won the travel costs, the cost of traveling for 3 months around Europe for myself and my sister, and enough to get us set up in London and afford the luxury of looking for work over a few weeks.
I'm going to have to ask you about that. Were you down on the floor with Andrew O'Keefe, was it?
And
your sister was up in the...
Correct.
And how much did you win? If I got my I'll be able to find it on the internet somewhere.
It's very cringeworthy. I won $22,500 Aussie dollars.
Nice. Are you a gambler? Did you go for the safe option when I'm just trying to remember how Deal or No Deal works? It's been such a long time since I've watched it.
Look, and it works differently to the UK format, actually. I like a bit of a punt here and there, I guess.
Was the 22 and a half the amount that the machine offered you, was it?
Yeah, it was. I think it was about my fifth offer. So you sort of start with all of the cases, and then as you knock different cases out, you know, the machine will spit you out a figure. And I hung in till around, as I say, I probably was made five offers before that.
What was in the case next to you?
Oh, I think I had $500.
Right. So that was a good day out then for you.
It was a great day out. I know we did the recording at 8 a.m. in the morning and I left there at 9 o'clock and called my parents and, job done.
An hour's work for 22 and a half grand.
Exactly.
I wish there was more of those jobs out there.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? It was actually funny, that experience as well. At the time, I think I was interning and working at a supermarket and doing the Style Council thing. And I was one of literally thousands of applicants. So when it came to the interview day, you go along and they interview you to essentially, you know, check what kind of talent you're going to make. I was working for a fashion PR agency. My sister was studying fashion. So what we actually did was we created these beautiful outfits and these dresses that were completely made out of the Deal or No Deal logo.
Now I have to find this on YouTube.
Yeah, it's something else. So we were able to inject a bit of our personality and, you know, what we did for work into how we presented. And I know hands down that that's what got us over the line. So again, you know, thinking about how you can tell that story in a way that's going to stand out from your competitors.
I'm just sitting here going, if I type in Lucy Allen deal or no deal, whether you actually pop up.
But I actually don't think I do.
No, you don't. Sadly.
No, and it was.
Are you married now as well? Because yes. Maybe it's under your maiden name.
It might be, yeah.
Well, do you know what? We're gonna have to ask you to send that to me later on, and then we'll put it in the show notes, because I'm sure everybody will need to see those outfits.
Right.
For no other reason than it's you know, it's a great way of showing people how, you know, you can, you know, stand out when it comes to things.
Exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. So, true.
Yeah. This is going to be a random question on the deal or no deal front. Do they film multiple episodes in one day?
They do. They film. So everybody gets there around 8 o'clock, and they film right through to 5 o'clock.
Right.
I think they film about 8 episodes in a day. Okay. So yeah, we were quite lucky. We were the first allotment. And then once you've, you know, if you've actually been up the front, they can't use you in the audience. So you get to head off.
Right. Okay. So you didn't, presumably you didn't have to do any more after you'd won 22 and a half grand.
No, I got to leave.
Wow. What a cushy job.
I know.
I suppose it would still be good if you were there till 4 o'clock and then you won 22 and a half grand, but, you know.
True.
Knocking it over in the first hour and going home and, you know.
Exactly.
Jammy, lucky, lucky person.
Thank you.
So back to what we're supposed to be talking about here.
Yes, yes.
The role I wanted to ask you about was the work you did for Levi Strauss, because that's a, you know, that's a huge global company. You know, with a fantastic legacy brand behind it. Give us a couple of there's some stuff that you talked about here with the Levi Knight collaboration and the commuter series and the opening of the Paris store and stuff like that. Give me a highlight from that whole that sort of time with Levi.
Levi's was one of the most amazing jobs I have ever had. You've hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, what a mega brand it is to work for. I mean, God, they created the gene. So it was just such an amazing experience. I was working in the marketing team then. And initially my first brief was that we were really wanting to increase the association of Levi's and its musical roots. It had quite a history of being ingrained in music and youth culture, but in the UK we wanted to bring that to life again. So my first campaign was the Craft of Music campaign, where we worked with, you would be familiar with Primal Scream.
Yes.
The old English rock band.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So we onboarded, we wanted to work with, you know, somebody who was really established and well-known and recognised and respected in the music industry. So we onboarded, well, first of all, we got really clever with some new media partnerships. So we ended up developing a partnership with Spotify and with Clash Magazine, and we worked with them to identify who was going to be the most relevant and impactful talent for a major music campaign.
And that's got to be really in the early days of Spotify as well, because...
Oh, it was the first time. I think it was the first time I'd heard of Spotify.
Okay, cool.
It was really fresh. And so you know, through their social listening and analytics, we were led to Primal Scream. And it basically curated in this huge gig at Brixton Academy, whereby we gave our shoppers and consumers the opportunity to win tickets to come to this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity with an iconic English rock band. And then we, in the lead-up to the event, we almost did a Battle of the Bands kind of style campaign, where we had a range of young, aspiring UK artists. We created a platform for them to come in and show their stuff at our flagship store on Regent Street. And then they competed for the opportunity to be the support act of Primal Scream on the night.
There was a lot of bands in the UK, a lot of brands in the UK that tried to tap into the music space, because it was ultimately still very cool. And it was one of those things that was never not going to be cool, because, you know, when a band stops being cool, then there's another band coming in that replaces it. And I used to work years ago, back when I lived in the UK, with Carling, who did the things like the Reading festivals and the Leeds festivals, and they've done a lot of sponsorship over the years, originally with the Premiership, football Premiership. And then they realized they'd done that one to death, and then started sort of going into music festivals and stuff like that. It's also, I also saw a lot of brands try and do music badly. And it's quite an easy thing to do badly. How do you kind of make that sort of stay cool? Because as soon as you sort of tap somebody like Primal Scream on the shoulder and say, do you want to do something with a big global major corporate brand? Most bands would just go fuck off because, you know, that would potentially tarnish their coolness. How did you keep it relatively cool?
Well, that's a great question. Look, I think, first and foremost, what was key to our success is the fact that Levi's has a rich history of being involved in music. So it wasn't too long a bow to draw to create a music campaign. Secondly, as I touched on with those partners, so with Clash and with Spotify, it was integral that we had the right partners who we could, leverage their reputation within the music scene and leverage that for our relevancy as well. So working with them for consult on who we should approach and some of the messaging around that and how we should go about it was key. And then I would also say we sort of adapted our approach with how we then presented the collaboration and the event. You know, if you look at the branding and the collateral, none of it was in line with the traditional red and white Levi's. We certainly had branding components of it, but it was black and white and it was made to look grunge. And really the whole campaign was centered around giving back to music fans and also aspiring artists. So it had a really nice message for musicians to be involved and to get behind.
Those were also the early days of social media. Was that something you were tapping into back then?
We were just starting to, So we started to feed out some of the content. To be honest, our hub of content was a microsite, which at the time we thought was pretty special. and that had a...
Back in the day. Still a microsite. That was the solution to everything back then, wasn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And, it was fully interactive. That's where people would vote for their favourite band for the support act. And we streamed the gig through the microsite, which at the time was, it was pretty cool.
Anything in your time at Levi's there... And that was about just over a year. But any time that you suddenly went, you know what, this is a bit shit, that you suddenly thought, you know what, we could have done this better, or it missed the mark, or something like that.
Not so much at Levi's, to be honest. The campaigns that we worked on at the time were just so much fun. I'll tell you what, between you and I, Simon, one thing that I probably could have done a little bit better was I had this, at this stage, I'm probably, only 24, 25, young, living on the other side of the world. Yeah.
Getting drunk at a walkabout every night as well, no doubt, probably.
Well, actually, that kind of links to the story. So. I got this incredible opportunity to be the UK host for the opening of their Parisian store on the Champs-Élysées, which, huge kudos for anyone, but at such a young age. And I got to take five journalists over from magazines and newspapers and the likes, and I hosted them over a weekend. And look, we had a lot of fun and we developed some cracking relationships that actually served me very well. I think throwing up on the train back from Paris with five journos probably isn't the best look.
Classy. But to be honest with you, they're probably expecting Kiwi from Australia.
Oh, they loved it.
Here for a couple of years. They were kind of probably expecting it.
It's all in the brand. Yeah, they loved it.
If you spend any, for anyone who's never been to a walkabout in London, that's pretty much stock standard for a night out in there, isn't it, really?
Oh, exactly. Great night out.
Did you ever go to the one in Covent Garden?
I did, only once though, so I don't know it too well.
I only went to it once and swore never to go back again, because after you sort of walk through it and your feet are sticking to the floor at every point in the place, you just go... Yeah, this is not my idea of a fun night out. So.
Oh, totally. We used to go and watch the grand final at the walkabout, so the AFL grand final, being from Melbourne, a big deal. And, it's something else being in a walkabout at 7 in the morning.
Oh, yeah. It smells so bad as well, doesn't it?
It does. It smells a bit like you're in Queensland, aren't you? You're based in Queensland. Yeah, I remember I've been to is it Bedrooms on the Gold Coast that actually just smells like feet? Have you ever been to that bar? Bit like that.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to say anything just in case I ever go there again. So, oh, dear. Yeah, there's a few places like that. Yes.
So we digress.
Yeah, so we digress. You came back to Melbourne. You didn't want to stay in London. You didn't think, or was it just you just sort of a short visa and you couldn't stay any longer? Or
yeah, exactly right. It was a short visa. But what I did do, I actually met my now husband whilst working at Levi's. I was his client.
Right.
Worked with the Spotify team, and we worked on that big music campaign. So yeah. He was the ultimate souvenir to bring back for my travels back to Oz.
My first wife. I'm on my second one at the moment. At the moment, this was right. My last. Let's say I'm on my last wife at the moment. That's there yeah. anymore. My first wife did exactly that. She was working in London, found me, and dragged me back here. So, so you came back here, ended up working for. See, Red Bull was one of those ones where I worked a lot in the alcohol industry. So I was rocking up to music festivals and doing sponsorship. With people like Heineken and 4X and 2E's and all those kind of things. And the Red Bull people were always there. You know, they you know, turned up in their little Red Bull cars and, you know, in their Red Bull outfits, and everything was bloody Red Bull left, right and centre. And everyone waited for them to get there because the Red Bull people were so cool. You've just been doing cool things really, haven't you, since Levi.
Yeah, it's a bloody cool brand. So the way Red Bull came about, I actually worked with Red Bull in my Levi's role. We did student in-house activations, and exactly to your point, we'd get the Wings team down there and leverage them for some extra cool around our in-store parties. And so I leveraged that contact. I got a referral from Red Bull UK down to Red Bull Australia, and I took on the role of state marketing manager. So my job was really to bring the Red Bull brand to life across Victoria and Tassie. My remit included the Wings team, as we call them, which is the sampling, promotional team. We also had about 15 student brand managers. I don't know if you're familiar with the student marketing strategy at Red Bull, but it is killer. And we essentially have marketing managers on all of the major Australian university campuses, and their role.
Explain to everyone out there how they do that, because I think there's some learnings from that for other brands.
Well, look, I mean, Red Bull is savvy in knowing that youth are their biggest market opportunity. But to your earlier point, around connecting a brand with music, it's got to be credible. And so you've got to have the right person actually being the spokesperson and being that conduit between Red Bull and students. So really it's a no-brainer that you would work with students, almost like ambassadors for the brand. We typically would recruit, I mean, it wasn't restricted to, but we would typically recruit students that were studying marketing, advertising, PR, they genuinely had an interest in those fields, typically quite high achievers involved with different societies, knew who was who on campus. And then my role would be to work with all of them and define, local campus marketing strategies. And it might be as simple as, we're going to sample at O Week this week, or it sort of built up to bigger campaigns. So we would do art challenges where they'd all be gifted a pair of Vans and have to make them over for a chance to win a year's supply of Red Bull. We'd do sports challenges. It was really sort of based on that student brand manager, what they loved, and the local culture of that campus.
I bet that was fun.
It was awesome.
It's not really a job, really. It's just kind of like a two-year party, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was so much fun. And I tell you what, it is so inspiring working with, these young student minds who are just starting out, and the ideas and the blue sky thinking that they have it's awesome. And if you can tap into that and harness that and trial things on campus, in a controlled space,
it's
so great for filtering into your broader marketing strategy.
The Red Bull brand is one of those ones that really hasn't budged an inch on its kind of core beliefs in a good 10 years, I would say. At least that's from my perceptions. This was back in, 2012 to 2014. Do you still look at it and go, it's still doing the same things that it was doing back then?
I think the Red Bull brand definitely has upheld, all of the values and attributes right from when it first started. I think that's what makes it so powerful and so unique. They definitely continue to play really strongly in obviously the sports space and the culture music space. I think it's just interesting how they're how they're doing things and really pushing the frontiers of amazing marketing tactics and strategies. When I started, it was right, it was about a week after Felix jumped from, yes, you know, from okay. outer space.
Yes, yeah.
And that, I just think, gosh, what a cracking idea. And what I loved about working with Red Bull is they leaned on the experts to actually help shape the marketing. So Felix was the one that first came up with that idea and pitched it into Red Bull, essentially. So they're really passionate about working with their athletes and their ambassadors about what they want to do, and then layering it into the Red Bull brand.
I always wonder how that translates to sales. I mean, I always assume that Red Bull must be a successful sales brand, but I certainly know from now versus 10 years ago, there's a lot more competitors in the marketplace that are, you know, in some cases substantially cheaper than they are. And Red Bull hasn't really varied. It's, you know, still the same cans, still the same, you know, yeah, there's bottles and bigger cans, but it's, you know, it's still focused around that small can. It became a call over the bar. Everyone wanted vodka Red Bulls. They didn't want, you know, anything else with Red Bull, with vodka. I always wonder how that translates into sales over the last 10 years, whether it's going up, whether it's level, whether it's losing market share, you know.
Well, look, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Simon, in the fact that there are a lot of other products out there that are very, very similar. So really it is the branding and it's the marketing and it's that brand personality that sets them apart when you're deciding between a Red Bull and a V, for example. So I know in my time, those marketing activations, particularly ones like Felix, had a huge impact on awareness and subsequently sales. I'm obviously not there now, so I'm not privy to market share or anything like that. But at the time it went a really long way in certainly raising awareness and consideration of the brand.
You've been with Thrive PR now 4 years. You've got a list here of brands that you know anybody would be envious to have worked with one of them, let alone the list that you've got here. The three that stand out to me would be Twitter, Coles, and Nintendo. Give us a couple of the highlights through that your sort of last 4 years with Thrive and things that you've really enjoyed working on, and perhaps things that, again, people can learn from in their own business, whether they're a big global company or just a small business.
Yeah, for sure. So Thrive, we're a corpse humor PR agency, is how we talk about ourselves, which means
new word.
It is Say a new word.
Corpse humor.
Corpse humor. Yes.
So it's corporation and consumer combined.
Yeah, or corporate and consumer corporate sort of merged consumer, into one. And
we love new words on this show. We make them up all the time. Okay, so corpse humor. I'm going to remember that one.
Corpse humor. Yeah, and look, basically what we mean by that is that we're the pros at balancing new age corporate reputation with brand, product, service, and promotion. So what we do really well here at Thrive is we take big corporate brands. ANZ is actually one of the brands that I'm directing at the moment, and we make them relevant and get them cut through within consumer outlets and publications. We're bloody good at what we do, if I do say so myself. We pride ourselves, as I mentioned, on that earned media space, but certainly in our opinion and our experience, PR, gosh, it's changing and it's diversifying. And really what we prompt our clients to do is think of it as being so much more than just a press release, but really taking into consideration the whole communications mix and how, where, when, and why they should be telling different stories.
Yeah.
In terms of campaigns that I'm really proud of and things that we've had a lot of fun with, to be honest, one of them was for the Salvation Army. So quite a conservative brand, a not-for-profit. So to your point earlier around, you know, budgets not always being huge. Yeah. And the challenge for the Salvos is that they really want to remain relevant and they want to be recruiting a younger demographic of supporters to ultimately, you know, fuel their fundraising channel, funnel. So the role here for us, we were working on the Salvation Army first peer-to-peer fundraising campaign. Essentially, it was called Be a Superhero, as in soup, because we know that soup...
Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We know that soup can be the hero for struggling families doing it tough, as it's quite cheap and can be healthy. So the campaign was essentially eat soup, nothing but soup for a week, and get your friends and family to sponsor you. A little bit like the 24-hour famine. So the challenge for us was... it's a very cluttered space. There's tons of different peer-to-peer fundraising initiatives. They wanted to appeal to a younger audience. So really we had to get quite creative with how we brought this campaign to life. And with a couple of clever partnerships, what we ended up doing was actually launching the world's first hunger-fighting cheeseburger soup.
Hold on a second. Cheeseburger soup. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're just going to pause for a couple of seconds and all contemplate that sentence that you've just said.
Let's digest
cheeseburger soup. Quiet for a couple of seconds. Right, we've had a thing about that. Explain to me cheeseburger soups.
Look, cheeseburgers, I'm sure it's the same in around the world. They're so popular. Everybody loves a cheeseburger. There's quite a bit of rivalry here in Melbourne around the different burger bars and who's doing what and, So we wanted to tap into that trend. And really the thinking started by, what food group can we merge into a soup that's still going to be interesting and taste good, but that's unique. So the cheeseburger soup was we approached a burger restaurant here called Easy's. It is, I think there might be one in Queensland actually. It's run by a guy called Jimmy Hurlston. He's an absolute legend. Right. And we approached him with the idea and tasked him with coming up with the recipe for the soup. And what it looked like in the end was I think it had a French onion base, and we had almost like meatballs that are made out of, cheeseburger patties, and then it had the full grilled cheese bun on the top. And it took a few weeks for him to nail the recipe, but it was delicious and it tasted exactly like a cheeseburger.
Weird.
So weird.
Can you still get it anywhere?
No. So the whole point around this was we collaborated with Jimmy, and for one day only you could order the cheeseburger soup. We also onboarded Deliveroo. So again, tapping into interesting partnerships relevant to a broad audience. We worked with them as our exclusive delivery partner. So you'd order through Deliveroo and get your soup. I think it was $10 and 100% of the proceeds went back towards the cause. So that campaign it achieved a couple of different things for us. It actually fundraised, so raised money for the Selvos. It produced incredible content around, the behind the scenes and the making of the cheeseburger soup. Great images and content around our delivery drivers. And then it also got us cut through with, major newspapers like the Herald Sun down here in Melbourne. We were across all the nightly news. We got cut through with the pedestrian TVs and the urbanists of the world. So it really, really elevated ultimately what was a peer-to-peer fundraising campaign.
Yeah, there's a startup idea there,
What are you thinking?
For anyone who's listening, who wants to go out and make cheeseburger soup, I think I can see it on the shelves of Coles. It's almost like a no-brainer, really. So maybe they could, maybe anyone who does go and start making mass producing cheeseburger soup could at least make a donation to the Salvos on the way through for everyone sold.
That would be lovely.
Yeah. obviously in your whole career through Thrive and all the early ones, what are some of the things you see businesses do badly? What's perhaps the one thing that you when you take on a new client and they go, oh, we've tried PR and it doesn't work and et cetera, what are they generally doing wrong, or what are they doing badly?
Yeah, look, from a PR perspective, I think the number one challenge that businesses have is taking off their business hat for a minute and thinking about the consumer or and the media outlet. So often we will have brands come to us and I don't know, they're launching a new product and this is what they want to say about it, and the whole narrative that they're trying to bring to life is really commercial, and it's what you would read in an ad. So I think there's a real education opportunity around putting your consumer hat on and actually thinking, why is this relevant to a news.com.au reader? Why would they care about this? It's almost like the pub test in terms of if you went to a pub and you were talking to your friends about it, Would they actually care? And so I think that the challenge can then be if the story itself isn't particularly interesting, like a peer-to-peer fundraising campaign, then what is the story that we can bring to life around that that ultimately is underpinned by the same message, but it's a little bit sexier and a little bit more interesting?
Yeah, I see that. I used to see that so often when I had my own agency that people would come in and go, we've got a story and we want to put this out to the media, and you'd read the story and you'd just go, oh shit, that's boring. You know, it's nobody's. Not only is that going to be a struggle to get that in the media, is that if it does, nobody's going to care.
Nobody's going to read it.
But it's hard to tell them that sometimes, isn't it?
Oh, it is hard to tell them that. And so what we love to do is you know, lean on examples of work that we've done previously and show how we've created a unique story that's still done the same job and achieved that same business objective, you know, just dressed up a little bit differently.
How do you attract new clients? What's the biggest way for Thrive to sort of get new clients? Are you going out and knocking on doors and cold calling, or are you reliant completely on an inbound, people coming to you? How does it work?
Look, it's a bit of a mix. I mean, we're quite lucky here at Thrive. We do have a really solid stream of inbound inquiries coming through to us. We also have fantastic referrals come through from, you know, brands that we've worked with, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It's our 18th birthday this year, actually.
Wow,
so
okay.
We will be celebrating. We leverage, you know, past clients that we've worked on. I think really, though, the key to our recruitment of new clients is sharing the great work that we're doing and the great pride we take in our existing clients. You touched on a couple that we work with. As I mentioned, we're also really proud to work with ANZ. We work with Spotlight. Optus is another one of ours. So working with these incredible brands and being able to really do amazing and innovative things in the PR space is an awesome lead for us to attract new business.
You started your own sort of side hustle just under a year ago. Two questions on that. What made you want to do that? And how does that work with your overall stuff with Thrive? Is that something that they support, or is it something they don't even know about and we've just let the cat out of the bag?
Yeah, so my side hustle is a confidence and career coach. And look, to be totally honest, I mean, I'm so proud of this amazing career that I've had in marketing and comms. But I'm a high achiever and a perfectionist, and I put a lot of pressure on myself. And my mum was diagnosed with a rare illness back in 2004 when I was at school, and I sort of watched her fight that chronic illness over many, many years. Back in 2015, she passed away, and it was in that moment that it was like a switch went off in my head, and I realized that, you know, the challenging briefs or challenging clients, tricky deadlines, the hard emails, really none of it mattered. And what was so important was that, you know, I was enjoying what I was doing every day, and I was able to leave work at work and have a really healthy mindset and have a little bit more work-life balance. So to be honest, it was that personal experience that opened my eyes to the fact that as marketeers, I think we're sort of built to be bloody hard working, really hard on ourselves. We do everything we can to deliver for our brand or for our client, and sometimes we forget to look after ourselves. And so I'm really passionate about working with high performers to help them get out of their own way and still achieve success and fulfill their potential, but do it in a way that's much more manageable.
And you're just doing that on the side, or is that something that you think eventually you would sort of go on and do full-time?
Yeah, look, I'm doing it on the side. And in answer to your earlier question in terms of how does that fit in with Thrive, I have never had someone support me like Thrive do, to be honest. Right. When I was telling them about it, I shit myself because I thought, are they going to be okay with this? Are they going to see it as competition? Are they going to wonder how I'm going to get everything else done? But that's the great thing about Thrive. They are so, so supportive. Our managing director, Leilani, is just so switched on. And, you know, her feedback to me was, we want the best talent and we want entrepreneurial talent. So it's a reality that those type of people are going to be exploring their own things, and we're fully supportive of that and happy to help wherever we can.
That's nice that they give you that flexibility to take that on. I mean, there's not a lot of, well, I say there's not a lot of businesses to do that. There's more businesses that are doing it today than perhaps were 10 years ago because they recognise that, you know, keeping good people is really important. But
definitely.
You know, I think a lot of other businesses perhaps struggle to sort of go, oh no, I don't want you doing that because you could be at the office at half a day or a day a week or something and you should be working on your clients and blah, 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 all those kind of things.
Oh, totally. And look, I mean, I think you've got to be respectful of your employer as well. And, yeah. and all of my work is done outside of Thrive, so it really doesn't impact it. But the great thing as well, and what Thrive is also very intelligent in doing, is that they're leveraging those coaching skills within the agency. So I'm right. coaching team members, and I'm able to bring that in here as well. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Sounds fantastic. Last three questions. What are your favorite brands? What do you like? What do you look to for ideas or brands that you always buy, or, you know, something that you always gravitate to when you're, you know, when you're purchasing something?
You know, I mean, from a PR perspective, I love brands that seemingly appear a little bit dry and do really awesome things. Okay. So one example of that is TAC, which is the Transport and Accident Commission here in Oz. And I just think it's incredible how clever they are at reinvigorating the same story over and over and over, which is around road safety and, you know, rising fatalities on our roads. And yet they're so innovative with how they tell that story. I don't know. Did you ever see the Meet Graham campaign?
No, it doesn't ring a bell.
I think it might have been Victorian only, but it was this incredible campaign. It was a couple of years ago where they had this great insight from research that allowed them to bring to life what a human body would have to look like to be able to withstand.
Oh yes. I do remember. Now you've said that, I do remember that.
It had all the nipples. You might remember it had lots of nipples down its chest.
I didn't remember that bit, but
okay.
If that's the thing that you remember, that's
really stood out to me.
That says more about you than it does me, Lucy.
So yeah, I just thought, God, that's so clever, and that got global attention, and was just such an interesting way to get people.
It was because it looked really freaky, kind of looking person, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was so creepy, and they toured it around the country, and I think it's now part of like a school education program, so it lives on Graham with his nips. So I think he's awesome. I think TAC is awesome. I'm loving, I don't know if you follow Kensington Palace on their social sites.
Can't say I do, no.
Gosh, you got to look at them. Again, super conservative brand, really embracing new age media, and again, a great example of a brand that's telling a story that people actually want to hear, and you know, making it interesting and engaging. What other brands? I've done a little bit of work with Kmart. Absolutely love what they're doing under the direction of Guy Russo. Their homewares collection, their homewares buyer, whoever she is just phenomenal. And the cut through that they're getting within lifestyle, you know, media targets in particular, and with influencers and bloggers is incredible.
Yeah, no, I'm sadly a Kmart fan, but that's just not there's not anybody, don't tell anybody that.
I am
gotta say slightly cool. Okay, yeah. Well, I say I am just so the two-year-old can run around the toy section. That's
nice.
My excuse anyway.
Yeah,
so second to last question, what's next for you? I mean, you've given us kind of where you are at the moment, and you know, what's sort of on the horizon for the rest of the year? Do you have any sort of new clients that you're working with, or plans to grow the side hustle, that kind of thing?
Yeah, look, all of the above, to be honest.
Okay,
as I
cool.
say, we're celebrating 18 years at the agency, so we're doing a lot of reflections on what we've achieved at that time and the vision for the business. We're growing pretty quickly, which is amazing.
Are you having a party?
Are we having a party? Simon, you're talking to a PR agency. PR.
Yeah, God, it's going to be loose, isn't it?
We're having parties.
You're going to be throwing up again.
You know me. No, we're having parties. Your invitation will be in the mail. We do actually have a Brisbane office.
I can't possibly drink anymore, but anyway.
And we're continuing to do great work with ANZ. It's one that I'm working on at the moment. They're doing really interesting things with their partnership with with Mardi Gras. So more to come from there then.
Yes, okay, cool.
There. Yeah, doing some great work with Spotlight as well. We actually, going back to the royal wedding, we did an awesome news hijacking stunt to coincide with the wedding recently, whereby we worked with a suite of Spotlight seamstresses and had them create Meghan Markle's dress overnight.
Oh.
Yeah, really, really cool. We were able to get in with it attracted global attention, and we hit all the morning news and the newspapers sort of 12 hours after we all saw the dress. So they're a fantastic client and looking forward to doing some more creative things with them.
Cool.
As well.
Wonderful. Last question. If anybody wants to get hold of you, if anyone wants to talk to you, ask you a question, get an invite to your party, watch you throw up over journalists, where do they, or they just want to see if you can make them a deal or no deal dress. Where do they get hold of you? What's the best channel to find you?
Look, the best channel to find me is through my website, which is at the Graceful Collective. So thegracefulcollective.com. There's a contact page there. It'll come through to me. If it's PR related, I'll move it into my Thrive inbox. And if it's coaching, confidence and career coaching related, I can respond on that platform.
Cool. And you're on LinkedIn as well.
You're on Lucy Twitter? Ellen. You know what? I am, but I'm not great at Twitter, to be honest. I'm a bit of a silent observer.
A lurker, as I call them.
I'm a lurker. Yeah, I love to lurk. Yeah, but no, I'm on LinkedIn. So Lucy Ellen, I put a lot of content through LinkedIn, so I'd love to see people on there as well.
Found out a lot about you today, Lucy, that you like to lurk, that you're into nipples, that you've... where you make your own deal or no deal dresses and you throw up over journalists.
And I'm a puker.
Yeah, that's probably the most insight I've had from any guest in the 30-odd shows that I've done. So,
oh, God.
Thank you. Let's hope your husband doesn't listen to this later on. That's all I can say.
Oh, thanks, Simon. It's been lots of fun.
Thank you very much for being on the show. Good luck with the Graceful Collective and obviously good luck with everything that you're doing with Thrive. And if anybody wants to talk to Lucy, please drop her a line. So thank you for being on the show, Lucy.
Awesome. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you very much for tuning in to episode number 32 of The Simon Dale Show. It has been fantastic having you along for the ride today. We really appreciate you tuning in. If this is the first time you've listened to us, thank you very much. If this is the 32nd time you've listened to us, then thank you even more. Please tune in next week. We should have one ready. We have an interview for you next week, and then we're going to have the Spin Cycle as its own episode in a couple of weeks. So once again, thank you very much for tuning into The Simon Dale Show. We will see you soon.